244-1777 is our local number. Toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to the University of Vermont Medical Center cardiologist, Dr. Peter Spector, is joining us. Doc, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
I'm good. I'm checking, making sure everything's okay. It's sort of a loaded question coming from a cardiologist.
Yeah, I'll be the judge of that.
So full disclosure, I have a bicuspid aortic valve, but that's not what we're going to be talking about this morning, because this isn't about me. This is about really a whole other different problem that people can have with their hearts, arrhythmia. So can you talk about what an atrial fibrillation, to be specific? Can you talk about what happens when that happens to somebody?
Sure. The heart is a pump. Everybody's familiar with that concept. But what maybe not everybody is familiar with is that the thing that makes the pump work is electricity that spreads through the walls of the heart. And when that electricity is nice and organized with coordinated waves that travel from the top to the bottom, you get a good squeeze and everything's good. What can happen in cases with patients who have atrial fibrillation is that instead of the electricity flowing normally, it swirls around like tornadoes in the upper chambers of the heart. It's very disorganized and alters the ability of that chamber to squeeze effectively. Luckily, it's the bottom chambers that are the business end of the heart, so the blood pressure is typically maintained. What you might feel as a person who suffers from atrial fibrillation is that your heart is beating erratically and typically very rapidly. So you're sitting at your desk doing nothing, and all of a sudden your heart feels like you're running a marathon, and you couldn't really quite tap your finger to it because you never know when the next beat is coming.
How long does that last?
Well, that's a very variable thing depending upon the person. There are people that have episodes of atrial fibrillation that'll come on spontaneously and last for just a few minutes, stop on its own. It can last hours or days, and there are even people that are in it 24/7 all their lives.
Wow, okay. If that happens to you once, what are you supposed to do? Go to the emergency room, call your doctor? What do you do?
Yeah, I think the answer is you certainly want to get in touch with your doctor, and whether you should go to an emergency room or don't need to go to an emergency room really depends upon how you are feeling. You know, if all you're aware of is that your heart is flip-flopping in your chest, but you don't feel, for example, short of breath or lightheaded or dizzy, then it's not necessarily an urgent, I've got to deal with this right this second, take an ambulance sort of a problem. But something's awry, and you ought to have somebody in the medical field take a look at you and figure out what's going on. There are many things that can make your heart flutter like that. Not all of them are atrial fibrillation, and they each have a different significance for your health, and they're treated differently. So best bet is to get an EKG if you feel that.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain to me more about what you mean by the electricity that goes through the heart?
Sure. You can think of the heart like it's a brick building. And what happens is all the bricks, which are the cells of the heart, get smaller, and then the whole building gets smaller. And when the building gets smaller, the volume inside the building is less, and so it pumps blood out. So the bricks are getting bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller. And electricity is what's telling those cells, those bricks, to get bigger or smaller. But unlike the walls in your house where you have electricity running through the walls, but that electricity is running through wires that go to a light fixture or whatever, in your heart, it's like those bricks are the wires. It's like the bricks are made out of copper, and electricity just spreads from one cell directly to the next cell and the next cell, which actually is part of how things can go awry. Imagine... have you ever seen the stadium wave where you have a whole column of people in the stadium stand up and then the people next to them stand up and around you go? That's a lot like what happens inside the heart. But you can imagine in fibrillation, instead of having a nice organized wave going around, you have, that wave is going and it hits I don't know, one of the exit tunnels, and then it starts to swirl around, and before you know it, people are standing up haphazardly, and that's sort of the disorganized electricity of atrial fibrillation.
Huh, all right. Let's go to Northfield. Fred, how are you this morning?
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Dr. Spector, it's ironic that you're on the radio because we were just talking about you a couple of days ago. Thank you. Thank you for being there. I suffered with SVT for better than 20 years. I've been in and out of the emergency department here locally for too many times that I can remember. I had to go to Boston to the VA hospital, and they did a catheter ablation to cure my SVT, and they could only get into the bottom section of the heart from the groin. And the surgeon at the time told me that he couldn't get it. It was in the upper left ventricle of my heart, and it was quite an extensive operation to get in to cure. However, they did shorten the electricity, the pathways, et cetera, and it's been good right up until September of this last year, 14. I had an emergency pacemaker put in. I flatlined a few times on the 3rd of September, and I have a pacemaker now, and I'm on medications, but the pacemaker has picked up the fact that the SVT is still there. It has returned, and it's causing increased medications, exploratory medications, and trying to figure out what to do to cure it. And the end result is, my question to you is, without the actual operation that is, I guess, is quite technical, the end result is it's just the medication's going to calm it, it's going to catch up, it's going to be taking more medication, it's going to catch up, et cetera, et cetera. What do you suggest I do? And I'm dealing with the guys at CVH, and they're truly professionals, and I really respect their opinions. But I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that can be challenging about problems with the electrical activity of the heart is that based simply upon how things feel, you can't tell for sure what's going on electrically because there's a lot of different things that can feel the same. And similarly, there's a lot of parts of the story that you just told that that could reflect a lot of different circuitries in the heart. So the way we fix things with ablation is that you're defining how electricity spreads, and typically you find what we would call a circuit. It's like picture a race car on a circular racetrack just going round and round. You try and identify where that track is, and once you know that, you would build a wall that goes straight across the road so that the car can't go round and round anymore. So the critical feature of that is knowing exactly where that racetrack circuit is. So from the story you've just told, it's difficult to know exactly where that circuit is. I would certainly think that it's not uncommon for people to have one of these catheter ablation procedures and for the doctors to have difficulty identifying exactly where the circuit is and therefore have difficulty fixing it. Those same patients can go on to have repeat procedures where they do identify the circuit and fix it. So I don't think the fact that it wasn't fixed in the past means that it can't be fixed. I would certainly suggest to your doctors that you might have your records evaluated by an electrophysiologist. So I agree with you that the cardiologists down at CVH are fantastic. I work with them all the time. There are sort of two kinds of cardiologists, though. There's plumbers and there's electricians. and for this, it's really worth talking to somebody who's a dedicated electrician. And there's folks like that up in Burlington, and there's folks elsewhere nearby. So you could certainly have somebody take a look at your stuff. But I would not necessarily resign myself to a life of taking pills until you've been reevaluated by an electrician.
The surgeon and the crew in the VA hospital down Roxbury, Mass., they identified it as coming, the problem of the SVT was coming from the top left ventricle, and he stated at that time that he wasn't qualified to perform that operation. And the reason I got the pacemaker anyway is a serious sinus node failure.
Well, those two things actually, they're really separate, but they can go hand in hand, meaning the same people that suffer from fast heart rhythms can suffer from slow heart rhythms, which is what the sinus node dysfunction is. And the pacemaker is a fantastic and very effective treatment for slow heartbeats. But it doesn't do anything, as you've already learned, to fix fast heartbeats. Ablations for to fix rhythms that are in the upper left chamber of the heart are somewhat new and they sort of push our technology of the field to its limits. So not everybody does feel comfortable doing it. But I would say that if those guys weren't comfortable, it's worth going to someplace where they are comfortable.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. We've been talking with Dr. Peter Spector from the University of Vermont Medical Center. How common is atrial fibrillation?
It's extremely common. There's many different things that can cause electrical abnormalities in the heart, but the most common is AFib. I think there's something like 6 or so million people in the United States and, you know, many, many more the world over.
Are you born with it? Is it something you develop? What's the source?
That's an excellent question. You're certainly not born with it, although there's some very rare genetic predispositions to fibrillation, but it still manifests later in life. But the vast majority of people develop it as time goes on. As we get older, we're more and more likely to develop fibrillation, so much so that people in their 80s have about a 30% chance of having atrial fibrillation. The only other interesting group with AFib is not older people or people with coronary disease or valvular disease or any of the other things you typically associate with heart disorders, but actually endurance athletes in their 30s or 40s who have extremely healthy hearts but can unfortunately develop atrial fibrillation as a result of some of the changes to the nervous input to the heart that occur with endurance training.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
It is really strange. So you see, you know, it's sort of interesting to look in the waiting room and see the different groups of people that are there with sort of the same problem.
Yeah, wow. Who would have thought that would be a source of it? So is there any indication what causes it? I know that's probably not the right word, but...
Yeah, no, I think you got it right. The answer, like so many things in medicine, is yes and no.
Uh-huh.
So we know that anything that causes certain types of electrical changes of the cells themselves in the upper chambers will promote fibrillation. We know what those changes are. It's the ability to become excited again sooner than heart cells normally are able to become excited. And the things that will result in that change are things that cause pressure or volume overload in the atria. So high blood pressure or coronary disease stiffen the bottom chambers, and so the top chambers, which are filling the bottom chambers, are exposed to higher pressure. Imagine what your cheeks feel like when you're blowing into a balloon that doesn't expand very easily.
Mm-hmm.
That's increased pressure in your cheeks. Volume overload in the top chambers can happen if your heart valves are leaky and you're getting too much blood flow into the top chambers. And so there's a number of different things that can lead to these electrical changes, typically through those same two pathways of pressure or volume.
And worst case scenario look like stroke?
Well,
or,
so
I
one
guess
of the possible
death,
absolutely
too.
Right. One of the possible consequences of fibrillation is that it is associated with an increased likelihood of blood clots forming in the heart. And a blood clot in the heart per se isn't dangerous as long as it stays there, but a blood clot that breaks loose from the heart will travel downstream, and the streams, like any river, that the streams are getting narrower and narrower as you get farther out into the vasculature. And when you get to a point where the stream is narrower than the blood clot itself, it blocks up flow. And if that happens in the brain, the result is a stroke, which is a devastating outcome. So it's important for people to know if they're at risk for it, because the best way to treat a stroke is to never have that stroke. And the best way to avoid it is to be on appropriate blood thinners in advance.
I want to get to this real breakthrough you've made in treating this, but we've got a bunch of people who want to talk to you, and I'd rather get to them. So let me take a couple of calls here. Let's go to South Burlington. Lee, good morning.
Hi, Dr. Spector. You did the ablation on me. I was my early 20s, and I was getting SVT. It was getting worse and more progressive. It started in my early teens, and I remember it was new for the hospital back then, but It fixed me perfectly.
Oh,
perfectly.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I was going into the ER probably near the end, probably 2-3 times a month with a heartbeat over 200 beats a minute.
Oh, my God.
And I think it was Dr. Claus at the ER back then, and they would, you know, do the whole thing where they'd pump me full of that weird stuff. And but you, I remember sitting down, and you explained the stroke thing and all that, and I was a little nervous, but I have not had one ever since the ablation. I have not had, one episode since.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah,
when was this?
I'm sorry?
When was this?
20 years ago.
20 years ago. Wow.
Yeah, so it was great for me. No medication after, nothing. So I recommend it. They do a wonderful job. They really know what they're doing.
Okay.
I just wanted to put that out there. Thanks. It's good to hear you guys talking about this.
Well, thanks for calling in. I appreciate that.
Okay, great. Bye.
Nice to hear a patient, 20 years later, huh?
Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story. I had a fellow come in one time who was a house painter, and he'd be up on a ladder painting the house, and he'd get these episodes pretty much daily where he'd get a little lightheaded, not like fall off the ladder lightheaded, but he'd just lean into the house until it passed and then get back to painting. And this was the case for about 28 years, I believe, at the time when he finally came into the office, and we talked about it, and ultimately he had one of these procedures, and luckily he was one of the folks that was fixed. He came in 2 weeks later to the office and he said, I can't believe I waited for 28 years when that's all I needed to do to get it fixed. And my response was, if it makes you feel any better, 28 years ago, I was in junior high school.
And not performing those procedures.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't start till high school.
But I'll bet you had one of those kits, the emergency, operation, that was the game. You had the tweezers.
Exactly. Yep.
Were you unusually good at that game at a young age?
No, I don't think so.
Let's go to Sharon. Tom, good morning.
Hey, morning. I had, and I'm knocking on wood right now, I haven't had any problems for a couple years or so, but my heart would speed way up, and I'd end up in the emergency room, and they'd give you that shot, and, then reset everything and send me on my way, and I was on a Tenol at the time, and I was pretty big back, and I've actually lost a lot of weight, and I haven't had a problem for a couple years, and I've never really, is there a correlation between, being out of shape and overweight and then losing the weight? And like I said, I'm knocking on wood. I haven't had a problem for a couple of years now, and I'll just listen.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Well, I think the answer to the question is you never know what's going to happen, medically speaking. They're typically losing weight isn't going to make abnormal heart rhythms go away, but there's no question about the overwhelming benefits for your health in general to lose the weight and get into better shape. So it's never a bad idea. But also, heart rhythm abnormalities can sort of wax and wane. So sometimes people don't have them until they become pregnant, or they have them and then they become pregnant and they go away, or they don't have them until they reach puberty and then that goes away then. So I think changes in your overall physiologic status can certainly influence how many arrhythmias you have. And I think you should be applauded for losing the weight and getting in shape, and hopefully that'll be the end of it for you.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Spector. So when you do an ablation, a catheter ablation, you do what? What happens?
So it's not a surgery. There's no knives or stitches involved. But what we do is essentially start IVs, and you can put a wire into an IV. It goes into the vein. And if you push a wire in a vein, that wire goes where the vein goes. And because the veins all go to the heart, your wires end up inside the heart without having to open the chest. Then we can record electrical activity. We typically will have something like 60 or so electrodes on 5 different wires. And we try to figure out what the abnormalities are and where the circuits are, if you remember the sort of racetrack analogy. And if we can find them, you can actually heat tissue with the tip of your wire, which causes a small burn. That burn heals a scar tissue. Scar tissue doesn't conduct electricity, and it's like snipping a wire inside the heart. So if it works well, you're fixed. No more problems, no more medications.
Okay. So you're somehow burning a part of the tissue so that it's no longer part of the electrical pattern here?
Yeah, so it sounds like a bad idea, right? That you would burn something inside the heart.
Well,
but it turns
yeah.
out that it's very much like a sort of a surgical strike, almost literally. You're taking out a very small amount of tissue, but hopefully a critical amount, a critical spot inside the heart that just interrupts the flow where you don't want it without influencing the flow significantly where you do want it.
Okay, all right. What's the big breakthrough you made?
Well, so the thing that turns this into a surgical strike, if you will, that makes it a smart bomb approach is that you go in with your catheters, and the first part of the procedure is diagnostic. You're figuring out exactly what is driving the abnormal rhythm in this person right here. And knowing that is like cheating because you know exactly where to go. You know where to heat the tissue to fix the problem. Atrial fibrillation, it turns out, is a much more complicated rhythm than some of the other ones we've talked about. So instead of picturing a single car going around a single racetrack, picture an enormous parking lot with hundreds of cars doing donuts randomly all over the place.
All right.
So it's much more difficult to identify specifically where the problem is or specifically where you can deliver an ablation lesion to fix that rhythm. And that's sort of been the state of the art up until and including right now. What I've been working on with the folks in my lab here is a way to figure out what's responsible for perpetuating fibrillation. And then probably more importantly than that, how can we use electrodes on catheters inside the heart to figure out which spot is the spot in a given patient? We believe we've figured out how to do that, and that's resulted in some new catheter design, some new signal processing algorithms, which is what the computer does with the data that comes out of the electrodes. All of that creates a map, picture a physical map, and that map tells us where we need to go with our ablation. So if that's all correct, then we will have now a patient-specific targeted approach to the ablation of atrial fibrillation, and our hopes are very much that that will markedly improve the success rates of the procedure.
So is it more of a kind of a shotgun approach before?
Well, so that's a great question to answer. So the only reason that we're doing anything at all now is that it's sort of a long history, but the short story is we as a field stumbled into a set of lesions, you know, put a line here, put a line there, put a dot there, and that will fix about 70-75% of people who have atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
We don't really know that well why that works or why choosing those spots, which we choose anatomically now, not based upon electrical recordings, but just looking at the shape and the lay of the land in the heart, we go the same place in everybody. And it just so happens to work in 75% of people, which is great, particularly for those 75%. But for people who have more advanced atrial fibrillation, who are in it all the time, it works probably in closer to 50%. And we need to figure out how to treat those other 50% or how to more efficiently treat the people that we are treating now. So that's what this new research is aimed at.
Okay. So do you do the old procedure and see if it works and then apply this new one, or do you just apply the new one?
No. Well, right now, we and everybody else does the old procedure because we're still in the testing phases. We're hoping to move to clinical trials in about a year, but until then, we're not ready to do this in people. So everybody's getting the same treatment they've always gotten right now.
Okay, so this is just a theoretical at this point?
It's moving past the theoretical. We're testing the prototype catheters and systems, but the FDA, quite appropriately, has a high set of standards for things you've got to, ducks you've got to get in a row before you're ready to try this in people, and that's what's about a year away.
Okay, so this is something that you've run computer modeling on?
Quite a bit.
All right. So how do they test this? On animals? How do they do that?
Ultimately, when you've really refined exactly what you think is the question that needs to be answered biologically, if you will, those experiments are performed on animals, and it isn't until we're convinced that it's a safe thing and it's doing what we think it's doing before we test it in people.
Mm-hmm. Boy, you know, that leap from the theoretical and the computer modeling, I'm not sure I'd be signing up to be one of the first five people to get this done.
I understand your feelings about that. I can tell you it's not really quite as big a leap as you might think, though, because the way I've described it, it sounds an awful lot like we did computer modeling for years and years and years, and then we're just going to try something cold in a person. When in reality, it's more like there's many pieces to this puzzle, and each of the pieces we've tested individually in people. So a lot of the parts of the diagnostic story, we've confirmed that, yes, in fact, we make this kind of measurement with this kind of electrode in a person, and it does just what we thought. So we've confirmed a lot of pieces of the story. The only thing that we haven't done is put it all together as one system in a person. So it won't actually be as big a leap as it might sound.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how far away are you from actually doing this on a person?
I think we're about 12 months away.
All right.
Which in the field of medical research means 20 years.
Okay. All right. And is this going to be done at University of Vermont?
Yes. Yep.
Anybody else doing this across the country?
Not yet. What'll happen is we'll do a pilot study here, and if the results of that are promising, the next step would be a multi-center randomized study, which would expand then beyond our region.
Okay. All right. If your heart beats fast when you see somebody you like, you don't have to worry about that, right? That's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. That's actually normal.
Who is the first, who came up with this originally? I mean, who is the first person that said you could stick a wire in somebody's heart and burn tissue and that's going to be a positive?
Well, interestingly, that's my old boss. So before I came to Vermont, I worked in at the University of Oklahoma, which I don't think is the first place that jumps to mind as the leaders in the field of much of anything.
No.
But the pioneer, the guy that figured all this stuff out, was a guy named Warren Jackman, who's really still pretty much a young man for the grandfather of interventional electrophysiology. But he's the guy that got it all started. And like I think many inventors out there, he trained at some of the best places in the country. And when he was a fellow, he started thinking, you know, I bet we could do this. And he presented it to his bosses, and they said, you're crazy, it'll never work. They discouraged him from trying it. He did it anyway, and an enormous field was born.
Wow, I'm glad I asked. I mean, what an incredible story.
Yeah.
So what have you run by what you're doing with him? You must have.
Yeah, it's sort of like running and telling your mom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So what, I've talked to him quite a bit over the years, and I think he's excited about this.
Yeah. Well, he must be kind of proud of his protege, too.
I hope so.
Anything else you want to mention about this and I haven't asked you?
Well, one thing I'd like to sort of give credit where credit's due. We have a big team here, and a lot of people have participated in this research and making this happen. And then I think, really importantly, we wouldn't have been able to get off the ground with this research if not for the support of the Evelyn Family Foundation, some folks that are right from here in Vermont who donated $1 million that really got the research off the ground. And when it led to the technology that we've been talking about, that donation got amplified, if you will, because patents were filed and those patents were licensed by a big company, which is the only thing, you know, without that, it would have stayed an idea on a computer.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I know Tom, and I spoke to him shortly after he had a procedure done up at Fletcher Island. I think he had a couple of stents put in. I mean, he just was so blown away by how you can go in to a facility on a Saturday morning, get, you know, all your plumbing basically redone, and you're out of there Sunday or Monday. I mean, it is just remarkable, isn't it?
It really is remarkable. You know, it used to be that you came to the hospital with a heart attack. They didn't do anything except for watch you, and you stayed for 6 weeks convalescing, all of which we know is a terrible thing to do now. And I talked to my father, who's a physician, and he told me about his days training back in the 50s where there was no such thing as modern telemetry wards. And if you don't know what telemetry is, it's basically like an EKG connected to an iPod that's wirelessly transmitted to the nurse's station. So we see every single beat you have. And these are critical in on cardiology floors now because we're watching for abnormal heart rhythms. But in his day, they didn't have that. What they had was EKG machines, and they would leave a particularly sick patient on a stretcher at the nurse's station, and randomly, whenever anybody walked by, they'd just turn on the EKG, take a look at it, turn it back off, and get back to business.
Wow.
So we've come a long way.
Yeah, I'll say. Let me take one more call and let you go. Let's go to Montpelier. Dennis, good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually more interested, and I'm in mid-60s, native Vermonter here, about doctors leaving the state and very few coming in. Are you attracted to our state because of the way we live, or do you think that there's hope for here in Vermont? And I'll hang up.
All right. Okay.
Well, I think it's a tough question. I'm certainly no expert. I can tell you my perspective, and that is, personally, I'm attracted to the state. I absolutely love Vermont. I've always wanted to be in Vermont, and that's for sure what brought me here. We have challenges because we're a small state, and small states don't have tons of money, and if you don't have tons of money, you might not have the sort of resources that you would have at a much larger, better-funded institution. I've been impressed so far that we do a great job, I think, making do. There's a lot of incredible stuff that has come out of the University of Vermont, despite limitations. And one of the things I can tell you is I went to medical school in New York City, and I found that a lot of people were there because it had a big name, and they wanted to be there for the big name, but they didn't really like the place, they didn't really like the school, and everybody was kind of disgruntled. One of the things I discovered when I came to Vermont in the first place is that everybody I've met in the medical system here is here because they want to be here. And it makes them all a lot happier, and it makes it a lot more pleasant place to be. So I think we're in pretty good shape.
Thank you for your time this morning. I really appreciate it very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Good luck in your efforts.
All right. Take care.
Dr. Peter Spector is a cardiologist at the University of Vermont Medical Center. We were talking about a breakthrough that that's going to go into clinical trials here on a very common heart condition, atrial fibrillation. Wow, some of the stories you folks had. Wow, 200, pulse rate of 200. Oof, baby. All right, moment of your time. Here's something that might get your heart racing. Why not head down and see our friends at Nutty Steph's? It's Thursday, my friends, so that means it's Bacon Thursday at Nutty Steph's, which means you could have a lot of fun down there this evening until about the midnight hour. Music and all sorts of great food available there, too. You could have a variety of different kinds of bacon, which you can put into things like maple syrup, some of our delicious chocolate. Some nice drinks available there, too. They have a nice collection of international beers, for example. You can bring the kids with you, too. It's one of those kid-friendly events. There are all sorts of great chocolate drinks for them, too. So stop on down. Make it this evening at Nutty Steph's. Where is it? It's right down there in the middle ground, right next door to Red Hen Cafe and Bakery, right off of Interstate 89, Exit 9, right there in Middlesex, right around the corner there from the Mud Studio and the Middle Ground Florist, now all part of the complex down there. But check it out. Nutty Steph's is available tonight, and also they're open 7 days a week for your chocolate and granola needs. That's Nutty Steph's down at the Middle Ground down in Middlesex. Speaking of the Middle Ground, so I got word this morning, you know, I mean, God forbid, I ran into him a couple of days ago. Maybe he could have mentioned to me, Randy George, one of the co-owners, along with his lovely bride, of Red Hen Cafe and Bakery. Today, White House honoring Randy George as part of the Working Families Champions of Change event. He was recognized for his work to improve the lives of working families in Vermont. Here's what he had to say. Our 42 employees are at the core of everything we do, the heart of Red Hen. That is why my wife Liza and I insist on providing paid sick days, an equal and livable wage, health coverage, and other benefits that help everyone balance the work they love with the life they lead.
through these workplace policies, we know we're making our employees more secure, our bakery more productive, and our business more profitable, and Mark Johnson happier. No, I just made up that last part. Through our work in past years to establish a standard of earned paid leave in Vermont, several, so Randy has been honored by the White House here. There's a lot of discussion in this state going on in the legislature about this idea of paid sick leave. But you know, congratulations. That's a big deal. And Randy, if you're listening, next time you win an award from the White House, you can feel free to brag about it if you ever see me. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back right after these very important announcements.
WDEV's Fairness to Fans machine fires up this Friday. You can win a pair of tickets to see the Red Sox take on Toronto Tuesday, April 28th at Fenway Park. You must be listening to win. To enter, send your name, address, and telephone number to contest@radiovermont.com and put Fairness to Fans in the subject line. Or mail it to WDEV, P.O. Box 550, Waterbury, Vermont, 05676. Then tune into Ken Squire Sports Friday at 12:15. If we call your name, you'll have 5 minutes and 50 seconds to call in and win. Fairness to Fans Friday on your Red Sox station, WDEV.
I'm Yvonne from VSECU, a credit union for everybody in Vermont. Buying a home is so exciting, but falling in love with a house that you can't afford can be so disappointing. Before you start looking, know what kind of a monthly mortgage payment you can afford. Start the loan pre-approval process before you shop and avoid the grief or stress of looking at properties that just don't fit your budget. There's so many different things that can impact your monthly mortgage payment. The interest rate, length of the term, your credit score, debt-to-income ratio, the down payment, private mortgage insurance. All that terminology is so overwhelming, but that's why we are here. At VSECU, we have mortgage loan originators all around Vermont who will walk you through all of these things that can impact your monthly mortgage payment. They'll help you buy a home that you can afford. Find out more about best practices to keep your mortgage payment low at vsecu.com.
VSECU is federally insured by the NCUA and is an equal opportunity lender.
April is one of the best times of the year to drive a new Nissan. Jack Castellaneta, it seems like everyone has some kind of sale, but even their sale prices don't beat a Formula Nissan deal.
If you've ever wondered why so many people are driving cars and trucks from Formula Nissan, come find out in April. Our simple, straightforward, factory direct pricing means you get more car for less money, period.
You're taking up to $5,500 right off the MSRP of select new Nissans, or get 0% financing for up to 72 months on 5 popular Nissan models.
Check the newspapers, check the internet. You won't find a better deal anywhere. And our selection compares with some of the largest dealers in New England.
Straightforward, factory direct pricing, all the selection you need, and exclusive Formula Nissan discounts. It all adds up to April being the best time of the year to drive a new Nissan for less.
We're on the Barry Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut and at FormulaNissan.com. Let us show you how easy it is to do business here.
.244-1777, our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. If you're looking for a great local internet service provider, make it our friends at gmavt.net. That's Green Mountain Access. You can call them toll-free right now at 1, or actually you call me, 1, or so you can call them at 1101, 1-888-321-0815, 1-888-321-0815. Want to get more information about them? You might want to do that before you call. Might answer a question, might raise one even too. You can go to their website. Got a lot of information there. It's more than just email that they provide. They can do all sorts of things for you if you own a business or as an individual that you need to get done in the internet. For example, maybe you own a business, maybe you have a website, probably should, and you have to have somebody host that website too. You can't just go and buy it, then you need to have somebody host it for you, so they can do that for you. And many other things that those of you that are in the business world, you know, if you don't have an internet presence in 2015, oh my goodness, it's like being in a cave, isn't it, back in the prehistoric time? So give them a call today at 1-888-321-0815 and on the web at gmavt.net. I want to get back to this story about Hillary Clinton and money in politics, because she's really making a lot of noise about how the system is broken and how hedge fund managers are too dominant in the system, and how she wants to get unaccountable money, as she calls it, out of politics. I gave you earlier the reaction of some of the big shots on Wall Street who are kind of going, oh, okay, thanks. You can say everything you want, but they're not afraid at all, was the point of that story, that she's going to impose any sort of heavy regulations on Wall Street or really do anything when it comes to this campaign finance issue. So let me share with you some of what is going on in this, because I think most people, most political analysts are looking at this and saying that she's really, this is a classic case that you see in you know, I guess all politics, where in this situation here, you've got the candidate running a little to the left here in the early stages here, trying to appeal to that you know, the progressive part of the party, which many people, as I mentioned earlier, would like to see Elizabeth Warren jump in. And I have to note this. I noted this earlier. I've been surprised. All of these stories about Hillary Clinton and who might run against her. You've heard about, you know, Martin O'Malley, you know, the former governor of Maryland. And the name Elizabeth Warren keeps coming up. I have not seen a mention in the past 10 days, 2 weeks, of Senator Bernie Sanders, who, I mean, really, this could be at any point him making his decision. I mean, it looks, for all intents and purposes, he's already in. So I guess I'm a little surprised to have seen no discussion of him. We did get a theory recently on the program. Somebody said, well, he really needs to change and become a Democrat and really kind of, you know, make this official, and then if he launches the bid, then he's going to get mentioned in all of these stories. In any case, so here's what Hillary Clinton is doing. She, the backstory on this is they start the story talking about her push for getting money out of politics by noting that 20 years ago, Bill Clinton, president at the time, derided the problems that were going in the loophole-ridden campaign fundraising rules, as they describe it, and how he was going to make that his number one goal first year in office. Then he ran into all of these fights over health care, and then the deficit came up, so he completely dropped the issue. As they say here, instead, he became an adept fundraiser, an aggressive envelope pusher, exploiting regulatory loopholes to raise hundreds of millions of dollars in so-called soft money for the Democratic Party, and eventually ensnaring himself in one of the most significant scandals of his presidency. So Hillary Clinton is now saying in Iowa this week, among the things that she said, is that one of her top priorities is to, quote, fix our dysfunctional political system and get unaccountable money out of it once and for all, even if it takes a constitutional amendment. Now, one thing that has changed since Bill Clinton became president is Citizens United. And there are, as a result of that case, as well as a few others, it isn't just that one, we now have this creature out there that are called super PACs. This is money that is not moving through the national parties. And it has these super PACs people can set up. Hillary Clinton's got one. There's a couple of them, several of them. They're expected to raise, I told you before, $300 million just from the PACs. They say that's going to be on top of the billion that she gets from private donations and money that she gets from the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. So these super PACs, unlimited corporate, unlimited union, unlimited individual contributions. I mean, you know, this system is so broken. But who is going to change this when it benefits you? I mean, it just seems we've really, you know, kind of created our own mess here, and expecting the people that are benefiting from it are going to change it. I think that's a little bit of dreaming there. Back at the State House tomorrow for another Friday. Hope you join us on the program. We'll talk with the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, Dave Mears, joins us on the program. Gov joins us as well. Hope you do, too. Have a great day. Come back and join us same time, same place tomorrow. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren. and AM 550 WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier. It is time for news.
AP Radio News.